Mysticism meaning a mitzvah. There's a story authored by Rav Nachman of Breslov. The story concerns a king, a queen, and a prince living in the palace. One day at lunch, the prince is seized with a sudden emotional disorder. He completely disrobes, climbs under the table, and starts to crow like a rooster. This is very disturbing to the king and queen. They call in their wise men, their psychiatrists, not the same group of people. But no one is able to improve the prince's condition. After a time when they've given up hope, a rabbi in the kingdom presents himself and says, I have a therapy that I believe will be useful for your son, but it is a radical therapy and therefore you must promise not to interfere. Since they have no alternative, they promise, whereupon the rabbi also completely disrobes, climbs under the table and starts crowing like a rooster. Now there are two of them under the table. That can persist for a number of days. One morning, the prince awakes to find that the rabbi has put on his pants. That's a shock. The prince says to the rabbi, I thought you're a rooster, just like I'm a rooster. Roosters don't wear pants. How come you put on your pants? And the rabbi says, couldn't a rooster wear pants? That the fact that I'm covering the lower half of my body with a piece of cloth change what I am a rooster wearing pants. Well, the prince thought it over. He says, I guess a piece of cloth can't change what you are. So he put on his pants. Next morning, he's in the shirt. The rabbi is shirt on. And the prince says, what's a rooster doing with a shirt? And he says, I mean, why couldn't a rooster wear a shirt? Step by step, the rabbi leads the prince back into all of the trappings of human behavior, still fully convinced that he is a rooster. And that's the end of the story. This story raises a number of interesting and deep questions. One that I'm not going to discuss tonight, but I just recommend for you to think about. Can a person be misled as to what he himself is? Can one make a mistake about one's own identity? Okay, but the other question that I am going to talk about tonight is this. What is the difference between a rooster and a human being? Where is the essential difference? Is it the fact that we wear clothes, or eat a certain diet, or sit on chairs, or speak, or think, or have morality, or free will? Where does the essence of the essential difference lie? Every philosophy, every religion, every worldview must have an answer to this question. And by the time I'm finished tonight, I'll give you one way of putting the Jewish answer to the question. But first, we have to briefly look at mysticism, meaning, and mitzvah. What is a mystic? A mystic is a person who says that our everyday world, the world of tables and chairs, and giants, and white dwarfs, and black holes, and intifadas, our everyday world is not the ultimately real. Ultimate reality lies in an entirely different dimension. That dimension has in it entities and processes very different from our world. And he, the mystic, knows about it. He knows about it from personal experience or because he's read the writings of others who've experienced it. So far, all mystics will agree. Now they split into two subgroups. Some mystics say that only the mystical world is real. Our world is only an illusion. Maybe if you've gone a little too far east, you've heard of Maya. Or maybe a little bit west of us, you've had the misfortune to have read The Republic by Plato. And you might remember, and you might remember Book 6 when Plato has a famous allegory of the cave. People are deep inside a winding cave where no sunlight penetrates. They are chained to one wall of the cave. Round the bend there's a fire burning. Other people are holding up figurines in front of the fire, which are casting shadows on the opposite wall. For the people in chains, the shadows are their world. Says Plato, what would you have to do to introduce them to the real world? Break their chains, lead them out of the cave, and when they see the mountains, the valleys, the rivers, the ponds, and the vegetation, and the animals, insects, and mosquitoes, when they get introduced to the real world, it's utterly different from the shadows in the cave. This is a model of the first kind of mystic who says that our world is like shadows. It has no reality. It's just a mistake. The real world is something entirely different. Mystics of this type usually end up on mountaintops or in caves meditating, cutting themselves off from this world as much as possible, since this world is only illusion. Then there's a second type of mystic. He says, our world is real. The world of furniture and astronomy. You did recognize the red giant and the white dwarf, didn't you? Black hole, you certainly recognize. And the world of politics. It is real, but it isn't what it seems to be. There's another dimension, the mystical dimension, which underlies our world. And only in terms of the mystical dimension can you appreciate the true character of the world in which we live. As an analogy to this type of mystic, let's think of the physicist. It's a table. Solid table. Now, the physicist says that it's more than 99% empty space. That ought to come as a shock. If you hadn't learned at the age of 4, it would come as a shock. What would make anyone think it's mostly empty space? I mean, it looks completely continuous. It feels quite solid. What will the physicist tell you? He'll say you can't trust your eyes and your fingertips to reveal the true character of the table. It looks chock full, and it feels completely solid. That doesn't matter. It's still more than 99% empty space. In addition, the physicist will tell you that this table is a hotbed of frantic activity. First of all the molecules are vibrating. And within the atom, the electrons are whizzing around the nucleus. Whether you used to believe in electrons whizzing around nuclei. And nowadays, they aren't there until you look. And in the nucleus, you have the neutrons and protons, which are exchanging gluons and thereby changing themselves into one another. There's a hotbed of frantic activity going on the table. And when you protest that my eyes, ears, and fingertips do not reveal any of this activity, it looks totally passive, totally quiescent. The physicist will say again, you can't trust your senses to reveal the character of the world that's in front of you. The second type of mystic has a similar message. Yes, the table is real. And so are the elements of astronomy and politics. But what they are, what they're composed of, what the rules are that govern their development, what they mean, depends upon how they look from the point of view of the ultimate reality, which is the mystical dimension. Now, Judaism, Torah, they're synonymous for me, is a full-blown mystical religion. And it's a mystical religion of type 2. There's a mystical dimension which underlies our world. It constitutes our world. And only in terms of it can you understand the true nature of the world in which we live. What I want to do is share with you one element from that mystical picture and then trace its impact on the meanings of everyday events. And then give you a description of what a mitzvah is in those terms, and then we'll come back to answer what's unique about human beings. You know that God is a creator. You may not know that creation is a continuous process. It's not an event that took place N years ago, value of N to be discussed perhaps on a later occasion. It's a continuous process. God is creating the world moment by moment. And as a footnote, I don't say re-creating. The term in Hebrew, mechadesh, means to make new. There's no re in Hebrew. Re raises special problems. The official doctrine is that he's making the world moment by moment. As
first day maintaining.
That's the problem. That's the same as re. And that's not in the word mechadesh. Mechadesh doesn't have any maintaining. It means make new. Chadash means new, and mechadesh means make new. Now, that means that whatever exists does so because of an immediate divine decision that it should exist. Not only exalted things like the human soul or the human body, but the animals and the insects and the plants and the minerals and even the empty space with its Heisenberg energy and virtual particles flipping in and out of existence. All of it is maintained moment by moment by God's current decision. That being the case, everything that exists is an expression of God's will. Everything is a potential bridge to relate to God's will. We who are aware of the world and aware of God as creator, each one of these elements in the world that we come in contact with is a hand extended to us from God. And it has a potential thereby to be used to grasp the hand and to constitute the bridge, or to ignore the hand, or even to perhaps destroy the bridge. It's up to how we use it. Now, I'm going to take about 25 minutes, 30 minutes to finish what I have to say, and then, because it has to hold together as a coherent whole, then I'll be glad to take questions. That means that everything that exists has a potentiality. A potentiality that can be realized spiritually, a potentiality, as we would put it, for holiness, depending upon how we use it. This idea was enshrined in an event in Rabbi Kiva's life. A Roman met Rabbi Kiva and said to him, according to you Jews, whose actions are greater, man's actions or God's actions? Now, the Roman had a trick up his sleeve. Yes, a toga has a sleeve. First of all, he thought, no Jew is going to compare man with God. God to them is an infinite spiritual creator. Man is just a creature. So he's got to say God's actions are superior. And when he says that God's actions are superior, then I'm going to hit him with circumcision. So if God's actions are superior, how come you don't take the fetus as created by God? No, you mutilate it. If God's actions are superior, how dare you mutilate God's product? That was Roman's plan. Well, but when he asked Rabbi Kiva answered that man's actions are greater. And when the Roman was unwilling to accept that answer from a Jew, Rabbi Kiva said, give me 5 minutes and I'll prove it to you. Roman said, okay. Rabbi Kiva went out, came back 5 minutes later. In one hand he had a sheaf of wheat, and in the other hand he had a piece of cake. He said to the Roman, which would you rather eat? You can guess a Roman's answer, can't you? He'll take the cake. Well, Rabbi Kiva said, God made the wheat, and man made the cake, and you just chose the cake. Furthermore, Rabbi Kiva said, when your children are born, don't you cut off the umbilical cord? And when the Roman admitted that they did, Rabbi Kiva said, so you don't take the deliverances of what you call the gods either. You also transform it. So why are you throwing a brick at us? What, two cuts are worse than one cut? And that was enough for the Roman. He got dismissed. But since we're Jewish, we get to ask questions. Wait a minute, Rabbi Kiva, you're comparing God's actions and man's actions by comparing wheat with cake? Is that a fair comparison? Where did the cake come from, if not from the wheat, which God made? And deeper, when we make cake out of wheat, we are taking advantage of the laws of chemistry, which are the way God creates the world, moment by moment. The answer is that Rabbi Kiva was shifting the comparison. He was comparing the product of God's actions with the product of man's actions. God creates the world incomplete. You can't eat raw wheat unless you're very desperate. I have heard of starving people who chew on the wheat to get out what few drops of nourishment they can get, but you have to be very desperate to do that. God creates the wheat and leaves it incomplete, and gives man the ability and the means to complete it. And that's a model for the world as a whole. The world is created with potentiality, and man's job is to realize the potentiality. Now, I will insert a political footnote. In this case, the potentiality is realized by a physical transformation. It is not always so. After all, you're dealing with a Roman. What would you expect a Roman to understand? He's asking about circumcision, and you answer him with wheat and cake. But not all transformations are require physical transformations, as we'll see for a moment. Eating an apple might be such a case. For what political movement did I insert that footnote? Feminism. Okay, onward. Now, now, yeah, that's right, because they don't get circumcised. Okay, got it. Now, that's the idea from the mystical picture, that everything has its potentiality, because everything is being constantly recreated by God, and therefore everything can be a bridge to God. Now, let's take that idea and see what impact it has on meanings of everyday events. Meanings. Well, let's see. I was trained as a philosopher. Let's start at the beginning. What is meaning? Is that the kind of thing philosophers ask? What is meaning? And then everybody goes, what? And falls asleep because it's not really interesting. Okay, let's push it a little bit. Is meaning a matter of how a thing is in and of itself, isolated, individual, autonomously? Or is meaning determined by relations, interactions, connections, consequences, context, environment? What kind of thing is meaning? Let's consider some examples. What's the meaning of a circle? Watch. Here's one circle. Here's a second circle. Sorry for the tapes. Here's a third circle. U.S. What's the meaning of a circle? What's the meaning of the word that's spelled P-A-I-N? Does it refer to an unpleasant experience or to ubiquitous food? If you happen to know French. Someone's in an automobile in motion and he puts his arm out the window like this. Is he signaling a right turn or is he making a political statement? Let's see. The meaning of a circle depends upon the context in which you find it. It could be a symbol for the sun, it could be a smile, or it could be a numeral. The context determines what meaning the circle has. P-A-I-N is either pain in English or pain in French, which means bread. And if someone says, why are you bringing in English and French? I spelled the word for you. Just give me the meaning of the word outside of English and French. The answer is that to take a word out of a language doesn't have any meaning at all. A word has a meaning only as part of a language. Put P-A-I-N into English and it's pain. Put it into French, it's pain, which means bread. So the meaning is given by the context in which it's used. And this hand signal, well, if this is going on in the United Kingdom, then it's definitely a political statement, because the driver is over there. Right? I'm not the driver. So even the hand signal has its meaning given by the context in which it occurs. Meaning is a matter of connections, interactions, consequences. Smoke means fire, because smoke and fire are usually related to one another. The meanings that we care about, the meanings in everyday life, are all matters of connections and relationships. Why is graduation from college a very meaningful event, and choosing your breakfast cereal an event of very little meaning? Because what goes into the choice of the breakfast cereal is 2 minutes of thought. No, 30 seconds of thought. And its effects last about a half hour. Whereas graduating from college requires 4 years of hard work, and then it becomes a stepping stone for a great deal of what you do afterwards. Graduating from college is connected up to the rest of your life. Choosing a breakfast cereal is not connected up to the rest of your life in that way. That's why the one is meaningful and the other is much less meaningful. Now, I know you could create a paradox here. You could say, if all meaning is a matter of relationships, how does anything get enough substance to relate to something else? Something can have meaning, must not have some meaning of its own before it relates to something else. Correct. Find an out-of-work philosopher and let him work on it. In the meantime, all the meanings we care about, all the meanings that are part of our lives, are connections, relationships, and interactions. So, anyone with a deep picture of the world, which induces new connections and relationships, is going to create new meanings. chemist tells you that the rusting of your lawn furniture is essentially similar to the burning of a match, and you protest, what do you mean? The burning of the match creates heat, light, and ash, and the rusting of the lawn furniture creates that orange stuff on the metal. And he says, yeah, but they're both processes of oxidation. If you have a molecular view of what's going on, then they are very strongly linked to one another, even though the immediate visible products look quite different. A deep picture of the world creates new connections, and new connections create new meanings. Let's take this element of the mystical picture, the Jewish mystical picture, and see what new connections it creates, and with those new connections, new meanings. I'm about to eat an apple. But I don't want to just eat the apple. I want to experience the apple. I'm from California. So, before I eat the apple, I think to myself, where did this apple come from? It came from a tree. And the tree came from a seed, which was part of a prior apple. Tree, seed, apple, tree, seed, fading off into the indefinite evolutionary past. Now, when I eat it, I will bite it, masticate it, swallow it. It'll enter my alimentary canal, it'll become absorbed, nutritiously absorbed into the bloodstream, and the waste matter will be excreted. It'll have a certain taste, a certain aroma. I could regard this as a crossing of the plant and animal kingdoms. I'm ready to experience the apple. But with the Jewish mystical picture on board, we're not quite ready yet, because that trail of apple tree seed does not fade off into the indefinite evolutionary past. It goes back to a definite beginning. The definite beginning, authored by a being who created and continues to create apples, meaning that this apple that I'm holding in my hand is part of my relationship with that being. One of the things he has in mind is that there should be an apple that I'll possess at this moment. Which means that when I enjoy the apple and benefit from the apple, it creates a certain sense of gratitude. He's provided me with this. Were he to ask something of me, being a moral person, I couldn't just ignore that. If I have a very lively sensitivity, when I bite into the apple and experience the pleasure, I could experience it as a caress. Now eating the apple is going to have a whole extra payload of meaning, because the Jewish mystical picture creates new connections for eating the apple. Indeed, this raises the question of physical pleasure altogether. What kind of meaning does physical pleasure have? Let me illustrate this with four ways to eat a steak. Four different ways to eat a steak. Way number one. If you just finished 5 hours of doubles tennis, come home, you throw yourself on the couch and you say, I'm so hungry, but I'm so exhausted. Knock on the door, you open it up, a good friend is standing there with a tray covered with a bell. He says, happy birthday to you, happy birthday to you. You take off the bell, and underneath is a 2-inch thick sirloin steak smothered in onions and mushrooms. And if you're a vegetarian, so it's all soy, okay? And you think, wow, that's great. Look at that. Opportunity. Swing of it, sit down, and you enjoy the steak. Way number two. You've just finished a very filling and satisfying dinner of hamburgers. Hamburgers? I just have to get that right. Push yourself back to the table, then knock on the door, you open it up, and your friend is standing there with the tray and the bell. Happy birthday to you. Look underneath. 2-inch steak, 7-inch steak, or soy. With mushrooms and onions, you think, oh my gosh, am I in a pickle? What am I going to do? I just finished eating. Yeah, you say, come on in, come on in. How nice of you to think of me. I'm so glad to see you. And then it hits you. It hits you. You say, do me a favor, sit down. I'll be right back. And you go to the back of the house, into the bathroom, close the door, and you. And you come back out. Oh, it's wonderful. Come on, let's eat. And as you sit down, you think, that's the value of a good education. I know what the Romans did at their orgies. That's what they said. It got me out of it. Second way to eat a steak. Third way, you are marrying off one of your children. I can tell you from experience, we have 6 children and we and her other all married. You marry off a child. That is one of life's most exquisite experiences. You know the child for 20 years or more? Okay, ours is 17 and 18. Your wife knows him for 8 months, 9 months longer. And you put so much effort, motivated by love, into the child, and the child gets to the point of maturity where the child can set up his or her own household. It's an exquisite moment. And since it's a Jewish wedding, it'll have all sorts of dancing and acrobatics and tomfoolery and joking and costumes and soaking your hat with lighter fluid and igniting it so your hat's burned. And goes on for 4 or 5 hours, so you're having a meal. And the menu for the meal is steak. That's the third way to eat a steak. Fourth way to eat a steak. Imagine a country whose ruler is universally respected, admired, revered. Imagine. Imagine such a thing. Try to imagine such a thing. Okay, now imagine there are 100 million people in this country, and the king has invited his 25 most trusted advisors to a special dinner party at the palace. Each of the 25 has received a gold embossed invitation, and you come with your invitation, you present your invitation at the door, take a seat at the table, and the menu is steak. What are the differences between these 4 ways of eating a steak? In the first case, with the double tennis, so you're the CIA member. The one who couldn't. Okay, we marked you now. Only CIA members are allowed to keep their phones on. Everybody else has to turn them off. Okay, so now, when it's a double tennis case, you have depleted your energy and you're hungry, you need to eat. If you need to eat, there's nothing wrong with enjoying it. In the second case, the human being is using his intelligence to lower himself beneath the animals. Animals eat on the basis of instinct, but they only eat when they're hungry. They don't empty themselves in order to eat more. In the third case, when you're marrying off a child, the experience of the food is incorporated into an event of much higher significance, much greater meaning. Marrying off a child. In the fourth case, with the king, I hope the analogy was transparent. Every Shabbos meal, every holiday meal, is a private audience with the king, capital K. We are attending the meal of which he sits at the head of the table. The experience is one of being close to and communing with the creator of the universe. Now, in that last case, the food is there, and the experience of the pleasure will be there, but it is only a minor contribution to an event of a spiritual character. This is the attitude of Judaism, the Torah, towards physical pleasure. You can't be against physical pleasure because God created it. Anything that God created, as we said, is a bridge to Him, is a way of reaching Him. But it depends upon how it's used. And physical pleasure can be used in a variety of ways, as the 4 ways of eating a steak illustrate. There's a statement in the Jerusalem Talmud that one of the sages says that when I get to the next world, I will be asked to explain every pleasure that I passed up. Why did I pass it up? On the other hand, one of the sages says that I testify, at the end of his life, I testify that in my whole life I didn't have as much pleasure as my little finger, and he was very wealthy. How do you put the 2 statements together? It depends on which kind of pleasure you're talking about. Pleasure that would be on the levels 1 and 2, I didn't have any of that. Pleasure on level 3 and 4, where 4 is incorporated into 3, where I recognize God, have gratitude to God, feel closeness to God, there, if I passed it up, I have to give an accounting why I passed it up. It was an opportunity to bridge to God. If I didn't take advantage of the opportunity, I have to give an accounting of that. Some of you know that religious Jews make a blessing before they eat or drink something. Why do they do that? Roughly, the idea is to get permission to eat it or drink it. It's not mine. God created it, and I'm destroying it for my use, for my benefit, having pleasure from it. So the vast majority of people make the blessing in order to eat. But there are a few, an exalted few, for whom the order is the opposite. These people say, when I think about the blessing, blessed are you, Hashem, our God, King of the universe, who creates the fruit of the tree. Notice the present tense. Creates, not created. Creates fruit of the tree. When I think of those words, I picture in my mind orchards. Orchards in bloom with blossoms of different colors and different fragrances. And then developing into fruits. Fruits with different tastes and different textures. I think of the nutrition, the beauty, the pleasure. When I think of that, I want to praise God and I want to thank God for it. And there's a blessing that enables me to do that. Only, Jewish law says, you can't recite the blessing unless you're going to eat something. This person searches for an apple in order to make the blessing. Here's where the apple and all its physical potentiality becomes an opportunity to do something spiritual. These are examples of how the idea of God continues to creating the world transforms the meanings of events in everyday life. Now let's move to mitzvah. What is mitzvah? So I'm sure you all know that mitzvah means commandment. From our point of view, from what we've just discussed, we could characterize a mitzvah this way. A mitzvah is an action which is appropriate to the total reality. A mitzvah is an action that's appropriate to the total reality. Remember, fables and prayers are real. Politics is all too real with our peace partners across the road here. But what it is, what its character is, what its true nature is, depends upon understanding it in terms of the mystical dimension. A mitzvah is an action which is right all the way down, not just on the surface, but all the way down to the ultimate foundations of reality. I want to illustrate what this means with two illustrations, one of which is fanciful, the other of which is all too real. Louis Pasteur discovered that foods contain bacteria, and that by heating them, you can kill the bacteria and thereby eliminate certain health problems. Pasteurization. Now let's imagine Louis Pasteur going around the French countryside trying to convince French dairy farmers to boil the milk. Farmers said, Louis, boil the milk? That uses up good firewood. You know, in the Pyrenees, it gets cold in the winter. Why should I boil the milk? And Pasteur says, there are bugs in your milk and they make people sick. Oh, says the farmer, bugs in my milk? You know what, Louis? Let's do an experiment. I have a very fine piece of woven cloth. Now, I'll pour the milk through the cloth, and we'll see the bugs. You know, the bugs ought to be caught on the surface of the cloth. And we'll see the bugs, right? Pasteur says, well, that's not exactly going to work, because these are invisible bugs. Mm-hmm. Oh, said the farmer, invisible bugs! Right! And that's why I have to use my firewood. He goes, listen, Louis, go back to Paris with your drinking companions, you know, and leave me alone. I'm a practical man, and I'm not going to boil my milk for invisible bugs. Now, the farmer can be ever so ironical and ever so amused. It doesn't change the fact. Fact is that there is bacteria in the milk, and the bacteria will make people sick. You see, reality is ever so politically incorrect. It doesn't care what you think or what you feel. It doesn't care what your ideas are. It doesn't care what your politics are. Bacteria are there. Period. That's an illustration of getting it wrong because you're not aware of the deeper dimension. But I made that up. Here's what I didn't make up. Let's think about the Russian Revolution. Who were the Russian revolutionaries? Many of them, the leaders, were educated, sophisticated. They had a theory of how economics and the consequential politics and social development work, the law of succession of political forms, economic determinism. That is to say, the economic system determines the rest of culture at the time. These were sophisticated people. Moreover, they were courageous. They were dedicated to improving the situation of humanity. Many gave their lives to bring revolution about. Well, as you know, It was a gigantic failure. What it did was create a society in which 10 people lived like kings and 90% lived like slaves. Tens of millions of lives were lost, and hundreds of millions of lives over three generations were ruined by this terribly mistaken philosophy. What went wrong? How could such intelligent, educated, and basically good people get it so wrong? Well, I'll remind you that not a single rabbi signed up. Of course, who cared about the rabbis? You know, they're ignoramus is lost in the Middle Ages. How could they know anything? But 80 years later, the rabbis look pretty smart. The rabbis who said this whole thing is a failure, it's unrealistic, it's not going to work, they look pretty smart. Now, Marx and company didn't have a clue as to the underlying mystical dimension, even though Marx was Jewish. They didn't have a clue. So if you're going to speculate about the surface without knowing the underlying dimension, you're not going to get it right. Sort of like doing science without a microscope. You're not going to get a lot of things right. Furthermore, they didn't even get the surface right. That's another problem. So these are two illustrations of what it means to miss out on the deeper dimension. A mitzvah is an action which is right all the way down, because the same God who created the surface and the deeper dimension gave the rules how to live in it. It's sort of like the manufacturer's manual for using the program. Now, I know that if you're really a red-blooded American male, you don't take orders from anybody. Nobody tells you what to do. You chart your own path and your own course. You install a new program in your computer. Nobody tells you what buttons to push. You push the buttons that you like to push. You're a free, independent spirit. Of course, at best you waste a lot of time that way, and at worst you may crash the computer. When Microsoft creates a program, so they give you instructions, because being the creators of the program, that's the way it will work best. And God did the same thing. He made a world with all sorts of dimensions to it, and then he gave us rules which enable us to work best in it. Now listen, this is the first thing I'm going to say, it's a little subtle. You don't need to know how it works in order to use it beneficially. But it's better to know how it works. And a Jew is challenged to learn how it works. And there's a whole literature of explaining how it works. So you have a middle ground here. On the one hand, you don't make it a precondition to know how it works. But on the other hand, your life is superior spiritually if you do know how it works. So that we're not praising robots. We're allowing robots in the lowest level of doing what's appropriate, but we are challenging people to know more, understand more, and do more because of their understanding. Okay, let's come back to the beginning and explain what's unique about human beings, and then we'll have time for questions. What makes human beings special? One way to put the answer is this. A human being has the ability to choose the meaning of his life. A human being has the ability to choose the meaning of his life. Let's take that apart, piece by piece. Choose the meaning of his life. What is the meaning of a life? Well, what is meaning? Meaning was relationships, connections, interactions, consequences, past, present, and future. The meaning of a life is how it fits. How it fits into the past, present, and future. How it's related to the past, present, and future. Now, that meaning can have small scope or large scope. It depends on how big your picture is, how well you appreciate the connections that your life has to the past, present, and future. But you can imagine yourself in different contexts, and you can appreciate the kind of meaning that your life will have in those contexts. You could go to Peru and join the Shining Path Guerrillas to help bring tyranny to Peru. Or you could go to Moscow and teach Torah to Jews. Or you can go to kibbutz and pick oranges. Each of those lives will have a meaning, and you have the intelligence to imagine yourself in those circumstances and appreciate the meaning that those lives will have. And to a certain extent, you have the ability to choose. Of course, the older you get, the more narrow become your opportunities to change, generally. But there are always some options that are open, and you can choose a meaning for your life. Now, last formula. The goal is to have a life of maximum real meaning. Maximum real meaning. Maximum, that is to say, as many connections, as broad connections as possible. You don't want to have a whole life just choosing breakfast cereals. Essentially, meaningless events. You want to have a life of meaningful events, like graduating from college, or marriage, or other things that are strongly connected. But, it's not enough that there just be connections. That the real connections. The communists had connections also. They had a picture of the world from beginning to end. They had a maximally connected picture. One trouble is the picture was false. What a person wants is a life of maximum real meaning. That is what the Torah offers us the opportunity to achieve. It is a picture of the world from beginning to end, with depth to the bottom and reaching the top, and it is a true picture. So as you locate yourself in terms of that picture, you have a life of maximum real meaning. I learned this idea from someone who had the providence and arranged me to meet this person when I was about your age, making this kind of exploration. He's a Hasidic fellow. That means he dresses in the funny hat and the long coats. Probably heard about them. They died out in the Middle Ages, right? Historical. And he said to me that his goal in life is that his children should look like his parents. And I thought, his goal in life is that clothes style shouldn't change? I mean, that's a goal for a life? So he said, no, I'm not talking about clothes styles. He said, I see a chain. A chain that starts with Abraham and goes to the Messiah. I don't want to be a broken link. I want my children to look like my parents. Another chain, another link in that chain. Here's a person, as he lives each day, as he makes each decision, pictures himself in the context of thousands of years of historical connection, both past and present and future. His actions have the meaning of living in terms of that context and building the future out of the past. That's a life of maximum real meaning. It's our capacity to understand this and to choose it that makes us uniquely human. Okay, questions? You got a question before?
If God is creating everything new at His will, at every moment, right? So there's nothing in the world, any system, any cycle that's self-sustaining?
Correct.
So at every stage, God is helping everything along?
Not helping, but making everything
making
along.
Making everything along.
Yeah. There might be one exception, human soul, but what you call the world, yes, that's quite true. It's a radical idea. It means there's no such thing as causality. It has all sorts of interesting consequences.
There's no self-sustaining anything in the world?
That's right. Yeah.
You said earlier that everything that God creates, He makes it so that we can connect to Hashem Himself. How is that with drugs? I mean, because drugs are harmful, but then how can you use that to connect to God?
Well, so far as I know, the drugs that are harmful do have uses that are appropriate uses. I mean,
for instance,
the painkiller. Morphine, for example. Now, morphine is a drug that you can become addicted to. On the other hand, it's a very important painkiller. And now, also, I should point out, the ecology people keep telling us that the loss of a species is an irreparable loss because we haven't the foggiest idea what these species can do. All we know is that each species is based on unique organic molecules. And there are potentially trillions of organic molecules, and if they're lost, we'll never get to test them. So we should try to preserve these things because who knows what wonderful properties they could have. Now, to say that a drug has no uses, I think would be very, very extreme. The question is to find what uses it can have. If you have a drug that's working, then you don't typically test other drugs. But to say that it doesn't have use is a little bit like the adenoids in the appendix, which had to be revised. When they found out that they do have uses, right? So my assumption would be that these matters have positive uses, We may not have discovered them yet. Yeah.
During the process of spiritual growth, you know, it's a lot easier to convince us in this kind of environment. Obviously, most, if not all of us, are going to choose to return to the environments from where we came, or at least for a while. You know, you can want yourself to do something, but it may cause, you know, discomfort. And there's all these ideas about being rational, you know, taking time, you know, taking years, however it takes. How do you know, say you want to keep a certain mitzvah, but your mind tells you, oh, you know, this might be too stressful. How do you know, rationally, a good process to go? In other words, when you have an idea that maybe I shouldn't do this all the time, how do you know that's a realistic idea or the yesahara or whatever other idea?
Okay, this is a crucial point, and I was going to discuss this later on your schedule, but I'll answer you briefly since you raised the question now. It's a very important question. What you need in this connection is self-knowledge. How much can I take? How much can I sustain? How much will be too disruptive? Now, I know of two ways to get self-knowledge, neither of which is perfect, but then nothing we do is perfect. But both of which can definitely help. One is to experiment. I don't know if I can handle this. Try it. Try it for a couple of weeks and see what happens. And when you try it for a couple of weeks, don't measure whether it succeeded. Make a bottom line evaluation of the whole of your life for the 2 weeks. Might be that you're trying X, and with a great effort you can make X work, but other things go to pieces. See what impact, whether trying to do X improves your spiritual life as a whole or not. If it doesn't, then it may be that you should wait 6 months and try again, or wait a year and try again. The other thing is to ask people who know you, and who have this kind of insight or have experience, and if there aren't such people, find such people and create relationships with them. Here it's like sports. A coach can very often tell a performer what he can and cannot do in a way that the performer himself has no clue. I work out, and I run. About a year ago, I was running for a half hour, doing 3 miles, and the fellow who's the trainer where I work said, you know, three times a week, he said, I think you should put on a fourth time a week. Run 4.5 miles in 45 minutes. What are you talking about? That's a 50% increase. You know, by the time I get finished with 3 miles, I'm tired. He said, I think you can do it. Said, that's crazy. You know, what about gradual increase? He said, no, there's no problem. You can do it. So, with my heart in my mouth, right now, my stomach and my shoes, I tried it. I was astonished. I did it. I couldn't believe it. He knew far better than I what my capacities are. Because he's a trainer. That's his job. So, the other way to get self-knowledge is to link up with people who have had experience, with people like you, and who can give you advice as to what you're able to do and what you're not able to do. Those are two ways to get information and evidence. They're not infallible, but at least you're not flying totally blind if you use those two ways of doing it. I'll have more to say about it at the end of the program, but that's a start anyway. Yeah.
I have two questions, but the most, I guess, related to his first is why. For instance, let's say a drug, why would we be able to find its negative uses before its positive uses? And why would it even be created to have negative uses or be able to have negative uses? Unlike, say, an apple, which I don't know if it has negative uses.
An apple comes,
well, you bet. I was thinking the same thing. Or about a knife. Right? Knives from the very beginning have had positive and negative uses.
I mean, but that's man-made. I'm just saying something created by?
Well, originally knives were just sharp pieces of flint, right? I mean, and those you can pick up off the ground and use for one or the other purpose. But look, life is all about choices. God created us in order to make free choices. We spoke about that upstairs already. And so, obviously, things are going to have good and bad effects, good and bad potentialities. Otherwise, there wouldn't be any choice attached to the thing. It's more characteristic that it should have both good and bad effects. Now, I could push it even further. Let's take diseases. So you say, well, diseases just hurt. Of course, you can get out of them, and the faster you get out of them, the better, but the experience is a disease. But pain itself can have a good effect. Pain itself can have a good effect on building a person's character, on forcing a person to take account of what's really important to life and what's not important to life. So the negative effects of things around us are negative only in the short term. It's only negative because they hurt. If one defines positive in terms of pleasure and negative in terms of pain, then there will be definitely negative things. If one defines in terms of spiritual growth, then there may be no negative things in the world at all.
Okay. And the second question?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I'm not sure if this digresses from the lecture, but would God want us just to study Torah all day? You mentioned that something about that God would want us to, you know, understand and study Torah.
I did say that, and you said it correctly. I didn't say all day.
Not all day.
Right, but now you're asking about all day,
well,
which is fine.
Okay.
That's fine. I mean, I just want to make sure that the background is straight. You said it right. I'm happy with the way you said it. I said it's important to study it, and you're asking whether it would be appropriate to study it all day.
Well, let's say, like, at this level right now, let's say at this, okay, all right. Yeah.
Let's take it that way. Look, there are many good things to do in the world. What happens if there are two good things, A and B, and someone is capable of doing both? So, either you say, flip a coin, or there's a hierarchy. And the hierarchy says that what you should do is the thing that you can do well, which is highest up on the list. Now, a life of study of Torah, study including teaching Torah, not just studying for your own private edification, life of studying and teaching Torah is the highest thing that a person can do. Why that is an interesting question, and there's a whole literature on it, but in the possibilities for lives, that is the highest thing that a person can do. So let's say a person has two capabilities. He can study Torah his whole lifetime, study and teach, or he can go into business, make $1 million, help support other people who are studying Torah, and study some Torah on the side. Which should he do? Study Torah, let $1 million go. As long as he can live decently when he's studying Torah. Someone supportive, let's say. So, it is an ideal in the sense that a person who's capable of it should take it. However, if a person is not capable of it, his life is not worth less. This is crucial. His life is not worth less. Each person, I meant worth, space, pause, less. It's not even worth less, let alone being worthless. That's where the single word doesn't mean what the pair of words means. Worthless means having no worth. Worthless means just less worth. God put us in the world to do something. A lot of different things need to be done. If you do what you're assigned to do, then you have a life as big a success as anybody else. Just that if you can do two things, that's important for you to know which one is more important. For that reason, there's a hierarchy of which one to choose, given you could do both. Okay? Yeah.
Shouldn't it be a compromise between the two?
It might be. Sorry. I'm glad you pointed that out. That's right. It can be that in some cases, a combination of the two will be superior to either alone for a particular person. That is quite true. Something else pointed out a couple of months ago, and I resolved to say it more carefully, and I made the mistake. Thanks for pointing that out. That's quite right.
Okay, I thought that it was important that it had even said it somewhere, I don't know where, that it's important for someone to have another job besides studying the Torah. Whether or not they're capable of doing whatever that other job is, that's important for them to do it.
Okay, you're right to ask this, and from the answer you'll see that it's a big literature out there. And in order to understand one statement, you have to put it in the context of the literature as a whole. Now, you're quoting Pirkei Avos. Tov Torah Derech Eretz Sheshneim Mashkachas Avon. It's good to have Torah together with a job, because in that way you overcome sin. One of the commentators says, we're talking to a person over here who wants to overcome sin. That's his position. Doesn't mean this is for everyone. That's a person who's working to overcome some terrible mistake that he made, some terrible crime that he made. But for the average person, that doesn't have to be the case. So that's not universal. I'm telling you, this is not universal. When you see that the reason for it, you see that it's not a universal prescription. Now, the Rambam, you may have heard this, The Rambam writes that it is forbidden to live off of charity in order to study Torah. That's only charity. The Rambam himself was supported by his brother, who was a gem merchant, for more than 10 years, and he didn't work at all for the Rambam. He himself was supported by his brother to learn Torah, and he did not work. Because this wasn't charity. His brother said, we'll set up a cooperative relationship, I'll earn the money. And when his brother was drowned in the Indian Ocean on a voyage for gems, he loved his brother, he was close to his brother, he was a big boy. And then he started working, he was a doctor, and he started practicing medicine. So it is simply not true that everybody has to work. For many people it's the right move, but for others it's not the right move.
I'm sorry, the first part where you said they have to work to get rid of their sin, I understand where does sin come from, why do they have to work to get rid of their sin?
That's a further question. I'm just pointing out that what you're quoting is not stated universally. It's stated only for a certain class of people, and there could be other people, another class of people for whom it's not necessarily correct. We have to go further to understand that, yeah.
Talking about this spiritual and mystical underpinning of reality and also linking with your comments on spiritual growth, would you let a son of yours, for example, marry a woman who comes from an adulterous relationship?
That comes from
an exceptional woman that comes from a...
Well, I think the question really answers itself. The fact that she has exceptional characteristics says nothing about the underlying spiritual base. And the underlying spiritual base is one which the Creator said, no, you're not supposed to do that. So it can't achieve spiritually what it's supposed to achieve. Now, just to sort of put you in the picture, just a little brutal, but Dessler has an essay in which he describes five different types of people in terms of their understanding of God and closeness to God and what things God will do to try to bring them close. Group five, according to Dessler, are people who are so spiritually dead, there is nothing that God could do to wake them up. Even immense suffering will not wake them up. Says Dessler, God simply abandons these people. And then they have happy, comfortable lives. Happy, comfortable lives. Like cows. Cows also have happy, comfortable lives. There's plenty of grass to eat. And they get milk so their udders are not painful. And they're protected from diseases. Until they're slaughtered for meat. But aside from that, their lives are quite pleasant lives.
So this person right? was then born.
So these people are spiritually annihilated. And they have very pleasant lives. So now, if you're looking at this woman and you say, oh, but I'm sure that our personalities are compatible and we could have a lovely life together, maybe so. Maybe so. Mm-hmm. But that lovely life together will cover up what was your great spiritual potentiality, and you'll never know. You'll never know what you lost. And I think, in case people, we should just add a little element of depth here. Does it matter if a person loses something that he never knows about? There are people who say, well, if he never knows about it, so he's not suffering from it, so then, what difference does it make? Well, imagine a community of blind people who are raised in an environment that's organized in such a way that they never discover that anyone has sight. They think their world is the world. Set up in such a way that they can function. Right? They're just instructed and they believe that everybody is like them. Right? Now, you have the capacity to give them sight. Is there any person doing that? They're not suffering. They're living their lives in a way that they think is perfectly normal without any disability at all. I don't think anyone would say, since they're not suffering, it's inappropriate to give them sight. Look what they're missing out on, and they don't know about it. They're still missing out, even if they don't know about it. So the fact that I'm not suffering doesn't mean that my life is okay. Yeah.
What would be the intelligent purpose for creating a person of the fifth category?
He isn't created that way. He's made that way by his own decisions.
Oh, sorry. Covering the soul.
I'm sorry. That's my fault. I should have been clear on that. Everyone is created with the capacity to be in the other categories. This takes work. You really have to work to deaden your soul.
That's somebody who's born you know, with some mental deficiency that for some reason.
No, that doesn't qualify. That doesn't qualify. No. Yeah.
Back to God creating everything new at every moment. How do we know that God didn't create everything and then make everything self-sustaining, so it's like an experiment, it runs by itself?
Okay, this is very important. Luzzatto, who's the figure that I have?
Does it actually say it in the Torah? That
well, it says it in the oral tradition. We recite it in the prayers every morning twice. We say God makes the world new every moment, and that's part of the oral tradition. And by the way, the oral tradition is just as genuine, just as valid, and just as holy as the written Torah. Don't get stuck on the written text. That's it's a rag doll man. It's not even a straw man. It's not Judaism. That's a famous trick of Christian missionaries. You know, you believe X? Sure, I'm Jewish. Where does it say it? Doesn't say it? Then you're wrong. You don't know what you're talking about. You don't know what you're supposed to believe, because they omit the oral tradition. The oral tradition goes much because all the way back to Sinai. That can be demonstrated, and therefore the fact that it's in the oral tradition is enough. Now, but the question that you asked is still an important question. Luzzatto says that God certainly could have created the world as self-sustaining. There's no contradiction in saying that. So the question is, why does he do it this way? Why doesn't he create it and let it be self-sustaining?
To add something to it. If it's not self-sustaining, isn't that taken away from the free will given to us in a way?
I think in a way, yes. But I will talk about that. There is a problem there, and it has to be reconciled, but there is a reconciliation. Now, Luzzatto says, this is what I was speaking about earlier, upstairs, the goal, is what I said tonight about the bridge, right? That everything that's created is a bridge to him. Well, if he created the world, like the deists say, he created the world and went on vacation and let it run on its own, then the things in the world could not be bridges to him. He wouldn't be present. He wouldn't be accessible. This way, he is supporting the existence of everything in your life. That being the case, whenever you interact with something, you're interacting with him. So he makes himself available for that kind of connection. Since ultimately the goal of life is to be connected in that way, so he doesn't just save the connection for later, but makes the connection possible even now. That's why, Luzzatto says, now this is in an essay that isn't translated into English, as he says, that's why God creates the world every moment rather than giving it its own self-sustaining nature and let it roll on its own. Yeah.
What was it? I forgot my question, but you might remind me with what you said. You cited something out of the Siddur, is it for?
Mechadesh, that God makes the world a new moment by moment.
Right.
Even anew is a little cheap. Makes the world new a moment by moment. Maybe so. Rav Dessler gives an analogy here to a moving picture. Okay, they don't move anymore; they're stored digitally. But you know, what is stored are frames, separate frames. Right? Now, when you see the video running, it looks to you like continuous motion, but it isn't. It's separate frames running at 18 per second or 24 per second, whatever the current rate is. Now, each frame is an entirely separate picture. No frame is affected by any previous frame or subsequent frame. They don't interact in any way. The only thing that keeps it coherent is the editor. There's an editor who makes the frames fit together in a coherent fashion. That's our world. Our world is separate shots, separate snapshots, created moment by moment. Moment by moment might be literally right, according to quantum gravity. Moment by moment, and each shot is a separate creation. And our illusion of continuity is only because the shots that are created are very similar to one another. The changes between from shot to shot are very gradual, just as it is on a video. The shots changes are very gradual, so that the experience has a continuity. But that doesn't mean there's any real connection between the different frames. In other words, there's any real connection between the different moments of existence. Yeah.
Why does he have to create everything anew every moment for there to be a connection?
I said, since he's creating things anew, there isn't a connection. I said, there isn't a connection. There would be a real connection if things had sustained existence. Then what happens in one moment could affect the next moment. If you're creating a new moment by moment, there can't be any connection from one moment to the next moment. It's a brand new creation.
No, not a connection from one moment to another. What connection to God. From us to the God.
Well, where will he be? How will he be connected? What will be the medium of the connection? Here, everything interacts.
How is medium, though?
Sorry?
How is him recreating the world every moment, the connection?
Well, let's say one more word.
I mean, our acts could be a connection to us, like putting on our tefillin, everything could be a connection, but I don't see how him creating the world every moment.
We have to say thank you.
No. Let's say the king has a rule. The rule is every morning put on leather boxes. Now the king is in the capital and I'm fighting a war someplace on the border. Right? So I put on the boxes. I'm doing what he said. But how does that connect me to him? It's just I'm doing his will, but he's there sleeping and I'm in the trenches and we're not connected at all.
God is everywhere, so.
Oh, now you're coming back to my side of the coin. He's got to be there, right? He's got
to
be there.
But he doesn't have to recreate it.
Oh, but then what sense is he there? What means he's there? Now, here...
Everything is self-sustaining. He's there. And
but what does it mean when you say he's there? The table is here.
He listens.
One second. Let's try to get straight on this. Now, there are people who will tell you he's there because he is everything. This table is part of God. There are people who talk like that. That's not the Jewish view. It is not true that part of God is wood, and that when I burn the table, I burned up part of God and made part of God ash.
His presence is with us always.
What does that mean? Those are nice words, but what metaphysically, what reality lies behind those words?
That means he's not off somewhere just
well, okay, but
on
that's
vacation, letting us just still
very good. Finish. But those are the same words again, right? So the question is, what reality lies behind that said presence? I don't see him, so he's not visibly present. So in what way is he present? If the table isn't part of him, which would be another way to do it metaphysically, and that's not true, and it isn't true, so in what way is he present? Now, the way he's present is that his will is creating everything around me, so I'm surrounded by his will. That's the sense in which he's present. That spells out metaphysically what it means to say that he's present.
It's not the thing itself, it's his will.
Well, okay, now here we come to another problem. When we speak about the thing itself, what are we talking about? I didn't tell you this. We'll talk about it. We talk about free will, hopefully. But you can't describe God at all. You can't really describe God. God is infinite beyond all description. All we talk about is will. That's all we can talk about. So, to talk about him being present, the him beyond will is just nonsense talk. What we have is will. So, for him to be present for us means his will is present. And his will is present in that he creates the world moment by moment. If he didn't do that, then he would be on vacation. There'd be no other way to describe what he's doing.
His will would be present. It's just he doesn't have to recreate it every moment.
What does it mean for a will to be present? If it isn't creating something or doing something, then the word present can be used. It doesn't mean anything. I can't just use these words. I have a meaning behind them. And I have to be able to describe some reality behind them.
I can be in this room watching everybody without doing anything.
Yes.
Watching every movement, everything. And I don't have to be doing anything to observe and have a connection.
Well, you can also observe if you're not there. You can observe by video, right? And you're not standing, you're not over there where he is, you're watching him from here. So what makes you over there?
Yeah, but if God is infinite, and yes. His will is present.
Yes. His will is present?
Yeah.
Yes.
Why does he have to recreate the world every moment for us to have a connection? Create that connection?
I don't know what it means to say a will is present. The king wills that you fight in the trenches. Does that mean his will is present where you are?
Well, you just said that you can't say that God is present. You said,
I said
explain him in terms of his will.
I said you can't say that. No, let's get straight. I said you can say he's present. You only have to explain what that means. One way of explaining it, that everything in the world is part of him, is the wrong way to explain it. Right? I want to say he is present, but I want to explain what that means. The word is just a cipher. Present means not absent, and absent means not present. But that doesn't tell me what reality lies behind saying he's present. Right? If I could see him, then I would say he's present, because I'm seeing him. I can't see him. So where is the presence? What constitutes the presence? Right? Now, if my highest conception of God is will, so then the will has to be present. What does it mean for a will to be present? It means the will is doing something there. If it's doing something there,
watching.
Then
watching that.
Well, I don't see how will that watches. But will is not the sort of thing that watches. Will is what lies behind an action.
Can you define will of God?
What's that?
Can you define will?
No, but it doesn't matter.
It does matter. You're using it. You keep using it. Okay. You have to define it to use it.
Nope. That's not correct. That's not correct. Were it correct, you could never use anything because everything would have to define something in terms of something else. You'd have to have an infinity of words to speak.
So
you don't have
there's no way to define will?
I'm saying, first of all, let's understand this
context.
Point. Let's understand this point. That you can't ask for a definition of everything. Because
yeah, but we keep using it. So it's meaningless to have this conversation if we don't define it.
That's why I don't want to go on to the second question, because you haven't understood the answer for this question. Now listen again.
Because
you can't define everything. You can't define everything because you need an infinity of terms to do the defining with.
Yeah, but can define it in the context of the what you're
you
using.
Cannot define everything. You cannot define everything. Because to define everything would mean you need an infinity of terms to do the defining with. Are you with me? That you cannot define everything?
Everything, I just want one.
So well, you cannot define everything, are you with me?
Okay.
Okay, so now if you want a definition for a particular thing, you need a reason why we need one. It can't be just, you can't talk about it without defining it. There are definitely terms we can talk about without defining them. Otherwise we wouldn't be able to talk about anything.
It has no meaning though if you don't define it.
So that's what you say. I haven't understood the answer to the first question. If that were true, we couldn't define it, we couldn't talk about anything. Because then you'd need an infinity of definitions.
You can't talk about anything.
No, he needs a reason. You need to give him a reason in order to...
Because the reason is that you keep using the word will of God, but what does that really mean?
Listen,
you're defining it in terms of what
I'm
you
not
want.
Defining it at all.
Recreating the world.
I'm not defining it at all.
That's pretty much what you're saying about the will of God, isn't
it? No, that's what it does, not what it is. I'm not defining it at all. Listen again.
I know what it does if you don't know what it is.
I didn't say I don't know. I said I didn't define. You say I mean, that means I don't know. I'm not saying I don't know. I know without defining. My position is I know without defining. And I'm telling you again, you have to take that position. Because if you say that without a definition, I don't know what it means,
okay,
then you can't know what anything means. Because you have to have a definition for the words used in the definition. You have to define them also. And with the words used in that definition, you need another definition to define them. And you'd have to have an infinity of definitions.
I don't know. It just seems like there's holes in the thing.
Well, I'm just pointing out to you that your position is one that cannot be sustained. I don't know. You cannot ask for a definition of everything. It's not true that without a definition, I don't understand it. That's simply not true. Because if it were true, then I need a definition for X. The definition for X would require words. Y and Z. Then I need a definition for Y and Z. So I need more words. A and B. Which you can't do, right?
Okay.
Therefore, you can't demand a definition for everything. There have to be some things you understand without definition.
What constitutes... So,
good.
How do you define that?
One step at a time. So now there have to be some things that we can understand without definition, right? There have to be some.
So how do you come to the decision that this has to be... We have to accept this as something as without
good.
Definition.
That's the first step. The first step. Not... You can't simply say we have to define it else we don't understand it. That's not correct.
Okay, so how do we...
Then we have to take it case by case. But you can't just say define it because otherwise I don't understand it. That's not correct. Now,
secondly...
Let's think about the process of looking for a definition. This is something that philosophers went through in the 30s and 40s. The process of looking for a definition. Okay, we don't know what justice is. We don't know what it is. If we don't know what it is, and someone offers a definition, how could we tell whether the definition is correct or incorrect? If we don't know what it is. How could we ever search for a definition if we don't know what it is? A lot of philosophy is searching for definitions. Whole books are written on justice. Why are they just shooting the breeze? Because we don't know what it is. If we don't know what it is, how can we judge whether the definition is correct or incorrect? The answer is, this week's Parsha, by the way, with the dreams of Yosef, if you look at it carefully. The answer is, when we say we don't know what it is, it doesn't mean it's a total blank. Justice. Maybe justice is marshmallows. Or petunias. Or sea lions. Or squares. I have no idea what it is. It's not like that.
It's not just idea of what it is.
We have a partial understanding.
Yeah,
the partial understanding. Now, when someone suggests a definition, what we do is compare the definition with our partial understanding, and we see if it fits.
Okay.
And if it integrates and explains, and if so, we could use it to clarify the parts we don't understand.
Can you relate that to will now?
You bet. Now, suppose, after all, we've been using justice and truth and beauty and and knowledge and belief as terms throughout cultures.
Yes, but we have a vague idea of what each one of those are.
Correct. And as long as we...
With each one of
I wouldn't say vague. We have partial understanding.
Partial. Okay.
And now, as long as you use the term within the area of partial understanding, you don't need a definition.
Now, where's the partial understanding?
One second. Let's make sure we've understood this before we go on to the next thing. Well, otherwise, I have to backtrack and do it again.
Okay.
Right? So if you have partial understanding, as long as you use the term within the area that you partially understand, you don't need a definition. Because you do understand that part of it.
Yes.
Okay, fine. Now let's take the term will.
Where's our partial understanding?
Well, first of all, a will isn't a petunia, and it's not a marshmallow, it's not a sea lion, right? I mean, we do understand that will is related to action. Will is what is behind an action. A will is oriented towards a purpose. Usually the will contains a conception of a means towards the purpose.
Hold on. Is watching and observing an action?
Is watching, it might be. I mean, a person might be doing nothing, but he might.
Observing us and created a self-sustaining system and observing us, and that could be the will of God?
It certainly could, but it wouldn't be present.
Why not?
It wouldn't be present.
Why wouldn't it be present?
Because you could observe something from a distance. You don't have to be present to observe it. You yourself can do that.
But
I said that to you.
Why does he have to be close for us to have a connection?
That's a new question. Now we're going to talk about a new question, right? The question
was relative to that question.
Well, but it's only if you give up on the old question. I mean, otherwise, we're going to go back to the same thing over and over again. then we have to finish this question before we go on to the next question. Now, if I said that he has to be present,
okay.
Right, and I say the only way for him to be present is that his will is creating things around us, otherwise it'll be distant. You say, what about perceiving? And I point out that perceiving can be done from a distance. So if he sees it, then therefore he won't be present. So we now have established that for him to be present, since he is will, his will should be creating what's around us, and that way he is
but
present.
But there are other actions that I'm not thinking of that could be thought of as God's will.
Well,
that could be present.
Look, when you think of them, you'll tell me about them.
Okay,
Now you ask, why did he have to be present at all? That's a new question. I think we've gone down the road far enough for now. Yeah.
What does it mean when you say that he recreates the world moment by moment? What constitutes a moment, in other words?
Okay, I hinted to that. According to quantum gravity, time and space are not infinitely divisible. There are chunks of time and chunks of space, and everything's sort of jerky, right? Only they're very small. They're around the Planck size of 10 to the minus 43 meters. So if that's right, then there are literally moments of time and minimal units of space, literally. Now, of course, quantum gravity is really kind of a dream. Nobody knows how to do it exactly. If it's not so, then I won't talk about moments. I'll just talk about continuous processes. I can do the same thing with the differential calculus. It's not a difficulty. I just used the word moment because it was easy to say. It's a continuous process with continuous input. Right? And both the process and our world are both continuous in nature. It is a big debate now about the mathematics of the world, you know, whether the world is infinitely divisible or not, and it would make a gigantic difference in adjudicating the conflict between quantum mechanics and relativity. Yeah.
Why don't we try to blow up the wall, since we know it can't be destroyed? If there's a positive justification for demonstrating that,
why don't we try to
blow up the wall, the Western Wall, since we believe pretty, you know, beyond a reasonable doubt, or so it says, that it can't be destroyed. If there would be a justifiable reason for doing that.
Because then it will be destroyed. Mm. If we're stupid enough to...
I hinted at this, I think, two Shirim ago. Mm-hmm. When you find statements of rules, I think that's put them in this. You find statements of rules, like this. In our literature, the rules are not meant to be absolute. I know of only one rule that has no exceptions. All other rules that are stated in the Talmud and the Midrash have exceptions. And this style, it's a style. It's a stylistic feature of rabbinic writing. And I recently discovered that you find it in the Torah as well. I mean, it was there the whole time, just didn't focus on it. There are times in this Torah will make a general statement, and then some place later, it'll make the statement of the opposite. And the oral tradition will say it depends upon conditions. But if you looked at the first statement alone, you would take it as a universal statement. So all of these cases, that free will can change. We spoke about suicide. You know, he said if a certain amount of money is set for your Rosh Hashanah, if you commit suicide, you won't get it. So these statements, all of them can have exceptions. And free will is the big leverage to have exceptions, because God's commitment to free will is greater usually than the commitment to all these things.
Okay.
So why don't we try to blow it up? Number one, because it's very holy and it'll be a gigantic crime. And number two, it might work. It might work.
Why would God let it work if God said, you know, the presence is sitting here?
Because of free will.
Well,
you want to go blow it up?
I mean,
but he's not preventing you from doing the action which would cause an explosion. He's not limiting your free will.
I don't think he's going to appear and stop the missile.
Well,
I mean, that would require an open miracle, and there are only conditions under which God wants to invest in an open miracle. Because of the impact that it has on people.
Why?
Open miracles reduce your free will. They very significantly reduce your free will.
Because you see God.
Right. Like Revelation of Sinai and the 40 years in the wilderness, those people had very little free will. And that was a big loss. It shouldn't have been that way. So you had a revelation and then going back into Canaan and lived as farmers. And as the psychological impact of the experience wore off, their free will would gradually have been restored.
So it was removed from them, the free will that was removed from them, or the psychological impact caused what?
It caused them not to be able to make fully free decisions. If you're surrounded by God's miracles, you're more like an angel. Right? And God says to do X, and you know that your food is coming every night just because God puts it there, and the water is coming miraculously, and you're protected from the UFO, the infrared rays by the cloud, you know. So am I going to take a chance to lose that?
Right.
If I'm a farmer, I have the illusion of doing it on my own. And then I can use my free will much more openly. Prophecy overwhelms a person while it's happening. Afterwards, his free will is restored. But if you have open miracles going on continuously, then the free will is very, very, very greatly reduced. Now, you said it right. This is a psychological effect. Psychological effects can wear off. Knowing something clearly doesn't always control your psychology, as you all know from experience. Yeah, last question. Then we got
Chris. Yeah, and just coming back, because we, in most of the lectures, we talk a lot about how to build the ideal situation, and we don't talk about the solution in case the ideal situation is not there. And so it was to do with a research I've been doing. So this, for example, a person that's product of an adulterous or a kidnap or a rape, etc., where is their hope for this person of spiritual...
Let's take
no
hope. It depends what you think life is, what it's appropriate to hope for. Let's take a person who has AIDS. Is there no hope for such a person? About 10 years ago, I heard of a case in California where they picked up a guy who gave blood into a blood bank, and they discovered he had AIDS.
Look.
And they said to him, "Why did you do that?" And he said, "I'm going to die. Why should I care if other people die?" This is a person who is failing the challenge of AIDS. Failing the challenge of AIDS. As long as a person can make moral decisions, as long as a person can develop his spirituality, then the fact that he can or cannot achieve one type of result or not that result makes very little difference. Some of the greatest people in Jewish history had quite short lives. The Arizal, who was the greatest mystic in the last 500 years, died before the age of 40. Utsato died before the age of 40. To mourn the lost years, you know, if I would do in all of my years what Utsato did in one afternoon, I would consider myself to be a great success. And so it's hard for us to really, really measure these things. According to Maimonides, Abraham offered sacrifices to idols with his own hands. He was 48, one of the texts is 40, when he discovered God. So did Abraham say, "I lost 4 decades. 4 decades of contributing to the world's biggest abomination"? He didn't say that. What he said was, "God put me there. I worked on it. This is how long it took me to figure it out. I don't think I could have figured it out faster. So that's what God wanted to happen." It happens that way with each person. The same is true with birth defects, or accidental injury.
So there is hope then?
Of course there's hope. The hope is to use the resources you're given in the best possible way.
can this person achieve the same thing of somebody who comes from an ideal?
That's what I said earlier. That's what I said earlier tonight. Your job is to insert yourself into the hierarchy at the highest level where you can be productive, or combine elements of the hierarchy in the best possible way. And if you perform your job faithfully, then you haven't done as much and deserve as much credit, will get as much credit as somebody who, through other God-given gifts, can insert himself into a higher part of the hierarchy. You only get credit for what you do, for your effort. Sato says this in The Way of God in three different places. You only get credit for what your effort created. Right? This, by the way, say this to you, maybe I did, about how Moses could be humble. Somebody asked how Moses could be humble?
Yeah.
Right. He can be humble because he says, my performance is outstanding, but I don't know how much it was mine. Okay, enough for tonight.
What is that?
If anybody wants this on email,
all right.